But of course you are. And as we like to say at this particular moment in time, with, of course, one of our fine voiceover artists who works diligently and carefully on a regular basis, saying things like...
Putting together an audio show which entertains and educates the globe is a piece of cake. When you've got the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Edition teens on the case for Siren 107.3 FM and sirenonline.co.uk.
Kind of handing over the mantle and baton in many ways, because Phil Hurwood, who, as he revealed yesterday, started doing these productions with me back in 1985, before you were born, Gabriella, but he had to step into the breach yesterday when his namesake, Phil Leonis, was ensconced in an exciting dynamic meeting that he was so sort of connected with that he just thought, let's just go with the whole thing. And being a consummate professional, of course, Phil Leonis said, not going to be able to make it, so we're going to have to sort things through. And if you get a chance to listen to the podcast, Phil, it's now been published from last night's show. You will have appreciated it was our Hannah Brown belated birthday special as well, so this is great stuff. Anyway, there you go. What do we do now? Oh, yes, it says here, it's time for the weather from Gibraltar, from Gabriella, before we find out what the weather is like in Los Angeles with Phil. Gabriella, it's over to you.
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 7 degrees centigrade, lows of 4 degrees centigrade. After a very cold start, it will turn cloudy with some outbreaks of rain.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
And on a day when already both Los Angeles and Lincoln and Gibraltar have actually moved into Thursday, February the 8th, 2018, it's good to see that there's been another update on the state of play of Fuzz Aldrin. But we'll find out about that in a few seconds, because for the moment, Phil Leonis, would you like to share with us your perspective on how accurate Gabriella's prediction of the weather in Lincoln has been from her vantage point in the Mediterranean?
Well, I do think that a low of 4 degrees is quite optimistic, since I think it's only 1 degree Celsius there right now. Probably feels colder. If I'm reading these tea leaves correctly, it's one of those days where it feels quite a bit colder than it actually is. It looks like you've got some sunny skies right now, but yeah, it's going to become increasingly cloudy with that rain throughout the afternoon and evening. Yeah.
But, you know, that's what we like in Britain. It's that kind of weather that actually provided an empire for us in times past. Gabriella, are you keen to find out what state Fuzz Aldrin is now in terms of her ineffable, indefatigable, sensational recovery that she's been going through, supported, of course, by Team Fuzz across the globe?
I saw the post on Instagram this morning, and I'm happy to say Fuzz looks really, really well. She looks a lot better. How's she doing?
Yeah.
She actually made a jailbreak on the way to the hospital yesterday. Got out of her travel case and was just... it was a free-for-all in the car in traffic, which was actually a very good sign. It's what's amazing is only now, some 6 weeks on, I guess we are, from when she got sick. Only now are we really becoming aware of just how sick this kitty was, how far from herself she had gotten. That's a phrase that Lily used, and I thought it was quite beautiful that Fuzz was at one point quite far from herself. But because her connection with us never diminished, we never looked at that. We never lost faith. And as her doctor now says, thank goodness we didn't, because it was probably that faith that allowed us to just stick with it and give her the time that she needed. And apparently her recovery for this kind of thing, because this disease, this illness, was in all of her organs at one point, the recovery is off the charts. There's no comparison to it. So... there's still work to go. I mean, her lungs were scarred, as happens to humans when they get pneumonia and things in their lungs, but it keeps healing, and it looks very good. She needs to have the esophageal feeding tube in for 6 more weeks, mostly as a precaution to make sure that she doesn't resist taking her medications orally. And finally, the neurological impairment, the wobbling, the basically needing to relearn how to do everything, how to walk, how to jump, how to play. All of this is coming along amazingly well. It might take months before she's fully back to the athlete that she was, but it's so inspiring. I use the word athlete because she reminds me of an athlete in that she will move to the edge of something and eye a jump, but realize that she cannot do it. But nevertheless, she will stay there and she will eye it for what seems like hours before walking away from it. And then the next day she will return to that spot and make the jump, as if she needed to just prepare herself and visualize it mentally. It's the power of visualization at work. So not only is she doing great, but it's just constantly inspiring. And I think this little creature who is able to recover neurological damage is no small thing. And her being able to shirk off the feelings of depression and the feelings of frustration that she shows when she can't do something she's used to, and learning again how to do it, it makes me think we humans ought to have a little more of a stiff upper lip when things go wrong with our health, because our recuperative properties are, they know no bounds, really, provided we hold the right attitude.
Just awesome is all I can say, and wonderful that you mentioned visualization, because you reminded me, of course, you prompted me to actually say, happy birthday, Mike Dooley, belated. Just again, about 24 hours late from that point of view, but Mike Dooley, of course, celebrated his fine birthday yesterday, and it won't be too long, hopefully, before Mike is back on the programme with all notes for the universe and so on and so forth. Needless to say, Gabriella, Frodo might at this particular moment in time be sort of thinking, well, you know, here we are. It's 9 minutes past 8 a.m. as far as Lincoln is concerned. It's nearly 10 past 9 a.m. in Gibraltar. They haven't asked what sort of state of consciousness I'm in. Do they care? Of course we do. So, you know, I mean, Phil, you care about the state of consciousness of Frodo, don't you?
I'm, of course.
So there we are.
That's on that. Quantum consciousness, never mind just consciousness. I want to know the state of her quantum, Frodo's quantum consciousness.
Yes.
Well, I'm happy to report he's so conscious, he's out on a walk with his granddad.
Oh.
So, my dad's taking him for a walk right now. So he's very happy. He was jumping around this morning. Mm. Well, after we woke him up from bed. You know, he needed an extra 5 minutes to regain himself. And, you know, he's not a dog who wakes up, ping, is out of the house. He needs his 5 minutes to realize that he's been woken up.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, I find, again, a little bit of sharing here, which maybe I'm maybe not interested in any way, shape or form, but I find it usually it takes me about 45 minutes to an hour to kind of get into a reasonable state of consciousness.
Yeah.
If needs be pretty much on it from the off, but I know that if I do that, it's like payback later in the day, and I just like, Phil, of course, just likes to engage in coffee to actually work through that. I say you can't beat a tuna fish sandwich, but there we are.
What a strange choice. Is that for breakfast?
It helps fire the thing off, I find, really. It's you know, dolphin-friendly, obviously, but it's the way forward, I feel. Shaylee McKenzie can't make it because she's working. Different kind of work, obviously, but she sends her best, and all the wonderment is actually there. Which means before we head off to Richard Fitzwilliams, and as we said, he's going to be reviewing Downsizing, which I was very, very nearly going to go and see over the weekend. Didn't manage to get there in the end. Journey's End, of course, fabulous stage play. Fabulous movie, I think. It was all about the First World War. Pretty timely as well from that point of view. Phil, are you able to stick around for Richard Fitzwilliams?
Yes, I'm looking forward to hearing about this Journey's End. It played at the Toronto International Film Festival, but it has yet to be released here stateside, so I'm eager to hear more.
Marvellous. So would you like to put those last two questions to our fantastic correspondent from Gibraltar, who was quite stunned to find, as indeed you will be, Phil, when you actually finally return to Lincoln, that now all of that heavy engineering is actually finished. We have a choice from the Siren Radio Studios of three different elevator shafts to look at. That's 1, 2, 3 elevator shafts that you can actually look at, people going in, people going out. Oh, it's just...
Siren's still on the ground floor.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, that's okay, perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need the lift.
No, we... It's very true, Gabriella, but I'm just saying, in terms of setting the scene here, it's almost as though we're kind of the international host scenarios. People wander in and decide that first choice. Which way do they ascend to levels 1, 2, and 3? Do they use the stairs? Do they use lift 1 with the masculine voiceover? Do you use lift 3 with the female voiceover? Do they use lift 2? I mean, Phil, there's a movie just waiting to be made about this. Anyway, enough of such stuff, because I appreciate that people, you know, might be listening in Manchester or other parts of the country, etc., over and above the Lincoln area, might sort of just feel left out, that, you know, there we are proudly saying Lincoln City have actually got to Wembley for the first time in 133 years of their history, and all he's spending time doing is talking about which lift they're going to go into. Well, it keeps us happy.
I love it. I've already written the movie. I've already got it in my head. It's called Elevator Shaft, and it's a sequel to the blaxploitation film series Shaft. Right? Shaft becomes security officer on the elevators at the University of Lincoln. It's fantastic. It writes itself.
Exactly, really. Exactly. It's a winner. And what do you think, Bruce Willis, or is he perhaps, do we need a younger version? Are we looking more Leonardo DiCaprio, possibly, in a vest?
Well, Shaft is black, so
yeah,
I think
I'm thinking
bit of casting.
No, Phil, I'm thinking diversification here. I'm thinking diversity. That was my choice there.
I think we add some comedy to it, and we get Kevin Hart. But the point is, I think I'm supposed to ask Gabriella a couple of
this
questions.
This is true,
and
exactly.
Which elevator shaft would you take, Gabriella? 1, 2, or 3?
I would love it if we could get a male voice, a female voice, and then some accent. So maybe we could have an American accent in the third lift. I would take it if it had an accent.
I see.
Wait a minute. These elevators talk?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. Yes. They interact with you. They let you know, A, that you're in an elevator, which floor you're actually on, whether the doors are closing or opening. All of these kind of aspects, you know, this is intelligent elevators we're talking about here. They're in a university, Phil. What do you expect?
Is it the voice of Major Barrett? I mean, what in the world? This is we're in the 23rd century here.
That's exactly what Larry Nemechek was saying yesterday, when we were debating on the birthday gifts we were providing for Hannah Brown. Anyway, enough of such stuff. We've decided that the answer to question one is only if the elevator has an accent. So what's question two, Phil?
Oh, did you enjoy your telephonic link with us here this morning, Gabriella?
Yes, I have. I found the elevator chat, and I'm very glad Buzz is a lot better. So it's good to hear.
It's helped you to ascend to another level. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that. Sorry, Phil. I take it then you will be back next week?
Yeah.
Elevator? I hardly know her.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere. A singer in a smoky room, a smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes.
See, the message is elevated. I hardly knew. Yes, it's great. It's humour. It's humour. It's American humour. It's fantastic, Phil. It's genius. I mean, that outro was just... It begged to have a classic rock track like Don't Stop Believing to emerge, sort of cut across that whole sequence. Only bettered by the opening words of our ace film critic, Richard Fitzwilliams, who says, "Is Phil there? I've got a quintessentially British or English story and tale to share with him." So, gentlemen, the floor is now yours. Richard, would you like to share the moment with Phil Leonis, whilst I also congratulate Phil on how well he's done not only to actually connect with us from Los Angeles, where it's now 20 past midnight on a fine Thursday morning. He's also managed to do a Facebook update about Fuzz Aldrin as well. Yay!
Excellent. Yes, greetings, Phil. Greetings, firstly. The story I wanted to share with you is linked to the new exhibition that has just opened at the Royal Academy, and this is Charles I, the Royal Collector. He used 140 paintings. It's very spectacular. And indeed, it shows from Van Dyck to being the great, one of the world's greatest propagandists ever, I think, because he portrays King Charles as the epitome of nobility, quite literally sent by God to rule over us. And you will recall Charles's great adversary, his nemesis, as it turned out, Oliver Cromwell. And what I wanted to share with you was the story of Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge. I was close friends with the Don at one time there. And whenever you went to dine at Hyde Table in those days, there was a portrait of Oliver Cromwell that looked down at you, but in a charming touch, there was a little form of net curtain that could be drawn around it. So, in fact, if they had a royal visitor, then it could be, as it were, closed off and Cromwell would not look down at them. It was delightful. They've only just taken it down, which I think is such a pity. And the other is, I assume that frequently when you're at dinner parties or whatever, people ask you what happened to Oliver Cromwell's head. The answer is that it was secretly buried in a place that no one will identify in 1960 in Sidney Sussex College. So you see, it's after all the convulsions, you could say, posthumous convulsions, his various parts of him endured after the restoration of the monarchy, his head is somewhere in Cambridge.
And how often, Phil, have those words been begging to be uttered on a Chilpack Hollywood Hour? Where exactly is Oliver Cromwell's head?
No, I know. I like to think he left his heart in San Francisco, but... Cambridge, that is, that's a good little bit. Of course, you got to understand, I'm in America, so our history education being what it is, when I share that nugget, the follow-up question is likely to be, who's Oliver Cromwell? So
in the history of the monarchy, we've only had one period, as you know, where there's been a republic, the Civil War, and Oliver Cromwell became the head of the Roundheads who fought the Cavaliers and, of course, eventually was responsible for the execution of Charles and a reign that became detested for its puritanism, impure though Charles I himself was.
Well, I mean, when you have the official title Lord Protector, it really does conjure to mind almost images of an inquisitorial nature to me. You know, it's a very reactionary title for someone to have, I think. Lord Protector. I think that's what our president sees himself as right now, is Lord Protector
yes.
of the U.S.
And you think when he dies, there'll be a crown placed beside him?
Inevitably. I mean, the fact that he's actually stopped the offshore drilling exploration by the parts of Florida where he actually owns property is just a wonderful manifestation of how he really cares about the environment. It's just the rest of the coast he's not really that concerned about.
Well, of course, just to draw this connection a little bit further, of course, Cromwell, if I'm not mistaken, was a member of the Rump Parliament, starting in the mid-1600s, and that sounds very close to the Trump Parliament.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Very good, indeed. Yeah. It does. And what Cromwell did to Parliament and how he packed it to get the verdict he wished with Charles and so forth, I mean, I think there's absolutely no doubt that when, and it's occasionally debated, I mean, the percentage of the population here that want a monarchy, well, the monarchy abolished is, oh, it's tiny. At the very, very most, it was over 20% in the 1990s. But it's a roughly 15, 17% and so forth. That people do think back the way, for example, playhouses were closed, horses quartered in
churches.
They
banned Christmas. They banned Christmas.
Well, this sort of thing that Alan Rickman in Kevin Costner's Robin Hood was precisely, it epitomizes the joylessness of the Puritanism, and also the fact that Charles II, who's been so well portrayed, I think, on screen and stage, was welcomed back with open arms after this ghastly period.
Well, they're talking about this tiny percentage. It seems to me that there is a segue begging for us to discover it
from that tiny percentage
to downsizing.
Exactly. Genius.
Oh, downsizing. Well, when we come to downsizing, firstly, my expectations were huge because I'm such an admirer of Alexander Payne. And, I mean, you go through this list from Election and about Schmidt and the Descendants, which I absolutely loved, and Nebraska and so forth. And then you find that I should perhaps have shrunk my expectations just a bit, because downsizing, it's a movie, it's so full of ideas, it becomes terribly, terribly self-important. And when you've got eco-messages about the world are threatened by overpopulation so that humans can be shrunk, I mean, bits of it, the bits that involve the actual shrinking, that the first half, so to speak, when we were examining a concept that was certainly unusual. I mean, Paul and Audrey Safranek, played by Matt Damon and Kristen Wiig, a couple who could do with more money. They look to the future. They think, move to Leisureland. They'll shrink to the height of 5 inches. The trouble is, it's irreversible. When he does, he finds there's a decided problem that occurs. No spoilers from me, as usual, but the facts are he's got problems, and also he's got a new life, and it's also the time when this plot takes off from being, as I said, it's a very clever concept, but once we get good old Christoph Waltz, I always enjoy seeing him as Dusan, who's a playboy, and also we get the link between his house cleaner, who turns out to be a migrant, who's got extraordinary connections, and then you get Paul, who starts visiting her in the slums, and you get a whole series of social messages, and actually end up in Norway, and the end of the world is threatened. Will you or will you not go into a vault which may preserve you? Then you find a movie that's lost its way alarmingly. I do have to praise Hong Chau, who's been nominated at several award ceremonies, of course, for her excellent performance as Ngoc and Tran. I thought she was extremely good. I always enjoy Christoph Waltz. Matt Damon, quite frankly, I don't think he adds much to this movie. I mean, it's a movie that had potential, but it's the second half that really, really goes wild. And if you've got the world being about to disintegrate with carbon emissions at the levels they are, and you've got Norwegian professors who fear this, and you've got also the fact that we're threatened by overpopulation, all these lots of weighty concepts, and this wonderful idea of the shrinkage, very, very funny, especially when Paul signs a certain document. There's plenty to laugh at and quite a lot to entertain and divert in the first half. For me, then, the movie, even if you bring an enormous pot plant to a party, there's lots of occasional moments of humor. You find that this sinks rather under its own I hate to say it to a paid movie pretentiousness.
Richard, I think we've got the idea. It's not one of your all-time faves. Does that chime with the fellow Norwegian background of Phil Leanus? Do you kind of turn around and say they would have been far better off actually listening to the 13th episode of the podcast relating the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, which is now released to the world?
So I don't think we've ever discussed this, but Alexander Payne was my mentor when I was in film school. He was very much an older brother to me. And what I love the most about the satire in Downsizing is his ever greater commitment to eschew the joke, to eschew the comedy in favor of the satire. He reaches for what's truthful rather than what's funny. And so I think there's much of Downsizing that works. I love how much they thought out that city. And just when you are beginning to think, wow, I'm so impressed how much they thought out this city, then Matt Damon's character finds the whole ghetto aspect of the city. And you're going, wow, they thought through everything. And that's why I think it is a bit of a disappointment in the second half when they leave the city to go to Norway, because they were really on to something so much about capitalism and consumer culture and our cities and city life and suburbs. It was really contained, literally and figuratively, in a story sense. And so I agree with you that it kind of loses its way, even as the Matt Damon character is finding his way. It's interesting what you say about the big ideas and the big messages, because Alexander's messages are usually much smaller, and they're much closer to the bone and much more about the frailty and folly of human character. And he said, actually, that with this film, he was beginning to feel guilty that he's one of the only filmmakers who's not making a global statement. And so you can kind of sense that it's an artist who feels like he should be doing something, so he does it. But feeling like we should do something is never the reason to do it. We have to do it because it is us, and we have something we need to express.
Very interesting. Now, firstly, I didn't know your real connection with Payne, and I hope that the original movies that I mentioned, absolutely joyous experiences. Yes, I mean, much to enjoy, as you say, with the with Leisure Land, and with also the idea behind it. The whole concept is, could have been, I think, much more successful. And there is a lot that was entertaining. It's just that the second half for me, and you agree, it does create a problem, because you've got, I have to say something important about the world and so forth, and I think a lot of reviewers have found this. It hasn't been a movie that scored, as far as I know, other than Hong Chau in award ceremonies. But it's nonetheless, I did find a lot to enjoy in parts of it, and the actual scenes of shrinkage and so forth, extraordinary.
Yes, but surely not bettered by the incredible Shrinking Man of the 1950s. Anyway, let us move on, because clearly time is awaiting, and Jason Connery, who was a fairly regular co-presenter back in the early days of this very kind of radio show we're producing, once went on to take part in what I believe was still one of his finest performances on the London stage, where he took part in Sheriff's Journey's End. And now there's been a movie been made without Jason Connery, but you're going to talk to us about that, Richard, because it was about 100 years ago when the end of the journey was in sight, as far as the Great War was concerned.
Indeed, yes, and it was interesting to see what this come across on screen, because I've seen a couple of theatrical adaptations of it, and it is very, very powerful. And a famous play by R.C. Sheriff, 4 years after the calamitous and terrifying slaughter of the First World War, there's going to be the so-called German Spring Offensive, and the troops in the front line, they have to hold at all costs, and we get a very, very claustrophobic phobic view of the soul-destroying conditions, how to retain a vestige of sanity. It's a tribute to the resilience of the human spirit, but there's absolutely no way that this film could in any way, because there is a certain patriotic element that's often associated with it. This is an absolutely, this is a human Golgotha that you see. I mean, this is absolutely, the conditions, the horror of it is not mitigated in any way. I'd make the point simply because I happened to be chatting to Mike Lee at the London Film Festival, and he was mentioning that Journey's End was associated with a certain patriotic spirit, which did not obviously appeal to him, and I thought this was an absolutely superb film. Captain Stanhope, played by Sam Claflin, is a decorated veteran. He's survived the grueling ordeal so far, relying heavily on drink, and his close friendship with Lieutenant Osborne, known as Uncle, played by Paul Bettany. So when Lieutenant Raleigh, played by Asa Butterfield, who worshipped Stanhope at school, uses the connection to join his company, Stanhope is appalled and fears his sister, who he's in love with, will find out how the war has changed him. And you've got a series of excellent performances from the entire cast, including Toby Jones as Private Mason, the chef. It's grimly realistic, visually very impressive. The eerie music is, I thought, most appropriate. And, I mean, the superb photography when there's a detachment capturing a German prisoner from nearby trenches, and much of it set in the officers' billets, which have a curiously painterly quality. And you've got scenes of men under tremendous stress trying to survive. Oddly enough, directed by Saul Dibb, he has made errors in the past, but I thought he did this exceptionally well.
And it's interesting to see that Jason Connery's role is played in the movie version by Asa Butterfield, as you'd expect, because Jason obviously was in his 20s when he actually did the original line, and presumably Daniel Radcliffe wasn't available. Never mind.
Well, there's always that.
Phil, does that float your boat in terms of seeing even another sort of midweek driver who's only got two shows ever to his credit? He'll forgotten all about us. Rob Glenister, of course, who plays the Colonel. Anyway, any thoughts that you'd like to share with us, Mr. Leedus?
Well, I'm fascinated. As I mentioned in the previous segment, Alex, this debuted at the Toronto International Film Festival to great acclaim. It has yet to be released here in the States. I would imagine that they're probably waiting until after the Oscars and after Dunkirk is played out completely. Because I bet there's a feeling that there's...
Enough already. I mean, this is a war movie where the Americans don't even come in, for goodness sakes.
But of course, Dunkirk being a British story, also the Darkest Hour, so is it that this was, they must wait a few, perhaps months more?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. And maybe they're waiting to line it up for an awards push, which would mean maybe we're waiting as long as even fall. But I'm really eager to see this, and I loved your I would give almost anything to be a fly on the wall and get to listen to you chatting with Mike Lee. I've been such an admirer of Mike Lee, and I bet Alex would give almost anything to hear an entire show of you and I just going back and forth about conversations we've had with world-class directors.
Oh, that would be absolutely fascinating. We ought to. It is interesting, of course. One thing I would mention, Saul Dibb, when I read that he directed this, I was just really wondering what would happen, because he made a total and absolute mess of the adaptation of Amanda Foreman's superb history, The Duchess, about the Duchess of Devonshire in the 80s.
I'm sorry, Richard, we once again disagree. This was one of Keira Knightley's finest roles.
In fact, it showed that she frequently has absolutely no depth at all.
Please.
And its picture of 18th century British life was pretty terrifyingly poor, and I have to say that, I can hardly exhume him to give evidence on my behalf, but my great-great-great-great-grandfather fought in at the period, the 1784 election for the Whigs. He was the secretary of the Whig Club. There's a monument by Flaxman, who's one of our top sculptors, to him in St. Paul's Covent Garden. And if he were here to give evidence about the scenes of the election and the London sequences, I mean, it wasn't London as we have it, for example, in The Libertine, which was London, the Johnny Depp movie where you could have the filth and the squalor, and there was a realism to it. Dibbs had a sanitized London in The Duchess, and whereas the costumes were spectacular, fair enough. The trouble is, who was wearing them?
Well, just don't worry about it. Incidentally, if anybody is wondering, though, I suspect the answer will be no. The casting for Journey's End was done by John Hubbard and Roz Hubbard, no relation to L. Ron Hubbard, just in case you wanted to clarify that.
Well, I would hope not.
Hate to find we'd have some Scientology sort of being crept in there. But that's a different line entirely.
No, Journey's End is it's a wonderful film. Is it important enough? Would it somehow get a lift to the of
we don't
being
know, Richard,
nominated.
And frankly, we'll have to put it to one side because time, once again, is that ever faithful companion that relentlessly and remorselessly ticks through the seconds. The
time's winged chariot.
Quite rightly so. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning, Richard Fitzwilliams?
Yes, indeed, and I'm so delighted that Phil was with us again, and I hope this will happen in future weeks.
Well, I mean, the clear line is we're still waiting for the official predictions for yourself and Phil for the Academy Awards to come winging our way. In an attempt to prompt that, of course, Graham Harper directed a recent episode of Inside Number 9, which, Richard, you were lucky enough to see, unfortunately.
Oh, it's terrific. Have you seen it, Phil?
No, he hasn't. Because
the BBC player will not work for me here in the US, so we need to find a workaround situation.
It's hilarious. I thought it was marvellous.
Well, there we are. And Graham Harper, director of aforementioned episode, will be joining us as Phil Leonis' warmer back next week. Hopefully, Phil, you're back on the midweek drive on the traditional 10 a.m. Los Angeles slot. Will you be returning for Wednesday and maybe Thursday next week?
I certainly hope so about the old traditional spot, but I like to think this is my new traditional spot, Alex.
Yes, a new tradition. What could be better?
It's almost as though Cromwell has decided to become reincarnated amongst ourselves to Phil Leonis and Sir Richard Fitzwilliams. Actually, I'm assuming, Phil, that you're actually leaving us. I mean, you can obviously stick around for another hour and 20 minutes if you wish, which takes you up to 2 a.m. in Los Angeles, but I suspect you're probably going to say, no, enough already. I'm going to take my rest and psych myself up for what is going to be an awesome Thursday, the 8th of February, 2018.
What you just said.
That's exactly what we like to hear. There's still a little question that I'll have to put to Richard Fitzwilliams regarding the National Portrait Gallery, but that'll have to wait until next week.
Time, do as I wish. Oh, time. do as I wish. Time, do as I wish. Oh, time, do as I wish. Do as I wish. I spent the day in bed. You can please yourself, but I spent the day in bed. Pillows are like pillars, life ends in death. So there's nothing wrong with being good to yourself. Be good to yourself for once and no bus, no bus, no rain, no train, no bus, no boss, no rain, no train, no bus, no boss, no rain, no train, no emasculation, no castration.
Morrissey, who spent the day in bed. Meanwhile, the Ian Lennox universe continues to expand on the legacies of his past work emerge here in a combination of masculinity, machismo and moping. The male characters are well-defined archetypes of bygone 20th century age of patriarchy with breathless brooding always close to the surface. Regrettably, the female protagonists tend to come across as stereotypical male fantasies running the gamut from adolescence to sainthood. Overall, well worth a look, especially for its insights into the world of illegal fight games, a novel which could easily serve as a template for a Guy Ritchie movie. My words on the customer review I put on that well-worn Jeff Bezos website reviewing Bare Knuckle. I gave it 4 stars. The Book of the Month podcast is also out and available now. You can find out what the final score was. Ian, were you disappointed? Were you punching the air with joy? Did you feel that was fair? I mean, did you sort of think, I'm never going to speak to that Manchester City supporting person again?
No, It was non-malicious. It was fair. I disagree with some of the things you said, but I suspected that you had a right to have them, and also that you didn't say them for any vindictive reasons or anything like that. It was just your honest opinion.
Yeah, fair enough. I still say, for me, it's nip and tuck between Gentlemen and Players and the Brothers.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah, I've constantly said this, actually, and I like this. But I just felt as though actually the thing really started taking off towards the latter part. You know, just effectively, no spoilers, but when we get into that whole situation of suddenly scooting off, taking on the mafia and a whole range of other systems or organised crime and balance and so on. And it was almost as though there's another book waiting to happen. So that shared Ian Lennox universe, bringing all characters together, that has to be, you know, there. I know you might sort of think, but that's an enormous task. But it's what the public are waiting for.
I've got an idea for another book, which I'm going to do. Oh. And incidentally, you know, it's the 60th anniversary of this week of the Munich air disaster.
I have indeed been aware of that. Yes.
And I found an old diary of mine as a young teenager, which I recorded the events. So I put them onto Facebook, and as I read my diary that year. Predominantly about football.
It was because you were having a failed romance of unrequited love at the time, Ian.
And about 6 or 7 people, not just on Facebook and other places, suggested I start writing a book about that.
Yes.
but unless I feel an inner urge to do it, I can't do it. It's not like, oh, that made me a lot of money, or that could be a good one. I'll just do that. Yeah. I've just got a feel I've got to do it, that's doing anything to it.
You're an artist. Artists can only be moved by the muse, not by the filthy lure of lucre.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, but some of my sort of ancient body and mind to work for two years at a book, I've got to really, really want to do it. So somebody else suggesting I do it isn't enough.
It's not motivation. You've got to have
it. It may be that they say to us, oh, yes, I want to do that. Mm. But it's never happened to me, and I've got an idea to write a book about sitting in a newspaper office or in a television office in the 60s, which has the potential to be a literary novel, which I've always and haven't written really since the Brothers.
Exactly.
And perhaps the gentleman players almost got there. So I'm going to try and do that, and probably this summer, and see what happens.
Having said all of that, and I see that in terms of the online website that Bare Knuckle is averaging 4.6 out of 5 stars in terms of the reviews that are coming through. So that's about, I give it a 4-star system. You obviously heard, presumably you heard what Jenny Finch and Rob Nichols made about it and so on.
Yeah, I thought Rob Nichols made a very pertinent point when during the criticism of some of the female characters, mm-hmm. when he said, "Have you ever seen Geordie Shore?"
Exactly. Funny enough, Ian, that's exactly what I have down here in my list of questions to put to Ian Lennox when we need to avoid the tale of how Newcastle United are not doing so well this season.
So
this question is, the Geordie Shore thing, which you're quite right, Rob, immediately honed in on, and I realised then, was that an influence in you? Are you a secret Geordie Shore
watcher? No, I'm not. I've seen sort of the thing I've seen is Geordie Shore, as long as it takes me to reach the remote control to turn on something else. I'd feared it would just stereotype Newcastle and Newcastle women.
Which it does, of course.
It
succeeds in that particular.
It's a very simplistic view of what Newcastle is.
Yes. But then it might be said that Newcastle folk are essentially. No, I won't go there.
However, the girl that they were talking about.
Yes.
Was in fact an extremely bright girl. She's probably the cleverest girl in Newcastle.
Yeah. Yes.
But deeply insecure because she was living. Because of her brain, she was getting a scholarship to schools, which contained children who came from a different class.
Yes.
Therefore, she was always surrounded by people who were not as clever as she was, but much more wealthy, which had not a very good effect. And coupled to that, she had a mother who was treating her almost like a sort of project.
Well, that's what happens when you're named after the Hebrew for God's joy, which, of course, is what Abigail actually is. Anyway, moving on from that point of view, Janine, on the other hand, simply your archetypal student doing her programme studies in a coffee shop and indeed at Newcastle University. What subject was Janine studying, by the way?
I don't know. I never really got into that by head, really. It would probably be something like literature or history, I imagine. I had a discussion with one of my friends who's a senior producer at a television station, well, Chinese, and she said that she thought she was a very worthy character, but she wasn't dull, but she wasn't as exciting as the other ones. Well, to me, she was like a little beacon for him because she was doing it was like a lighthouse for him because after his disastrous affair with Abby, he'd sort of started to go around the town or as many affairs as he could, one night stands, I suppose, as the crew were putting it. And but she was some arresting influence on him. He became bored of what he was doing, and she was still there as a some sort of steadying
an anchor is the term you're looking for.
Yeah,
an anchor.
Possibly, yeah,
an emotional anchor. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes, but I'm changing it. As you know, I'm revising it, and I'm trying to make her character a little bit more round than it is.
So actually, that early cut that we've actually had, there could well be a writer's version coming through, a writer's cut. And, as I said, a novel which could easily serve as a template for a Guy Ritchie movie. Yes, lots of action and adventure, lots of bare-knuckle fighting, lots of, say, Simon and Garfunkel songs. But well done. If you are interested, and why shouldn't you be, in getting hold of a copy of Bare Knuckle, it is available online and downloadable right now. Simply actually go into various online stores and type in the words Bare Knuckle, or indeed Ian Lennox, and the magic will manifest itself. Look out for the fist. Don't not in a scary way, it's Glenn McCrory's fist. But it's a nice start.
I saw him yesterday, yesterday.
Well, you should invite him to do one of these radio links with us. You know,
he'd be too expensive. I'll also ask Anne Jones, who's a friend of mine, who's the world speed reading champion.
And we look forward to future.
And you're having an interesting conversation. As an academic yourself, Alex, who I presume still has to read a lot.
Yes.
Her expertise would be extremely valuable for you.
Well,
because she can teach people how to read much quicker.
Indeed.
And take in the same amount of information.
It's going to be wonderful getting Anne back on the programme because it's...
Oh, you've spoken to Anne before.
Four or five years since we last featured her. So
oh, right.
It's time
okay,
she
I'll give
returned.
Her a
exactly.
Yeah.
High time she returned. Ian, Ollie and Oboe, State of Play, how are they?
Ollie's still got his sight disease, but he seemed. I'm hoping he's in remission.
Mm-hmm.
But he's just having his breakfast at the moment. Oboe has been out at night. He can tend to go out a lot at night. So I don't know where he is at the moment.
Well, you know, it can happen, and who knows what sort of delights will be coming through on that. In the second part of the programme, we'll be speaking to Alice Beer, consumer champion. We'll be talking to Ace TV presenter Lisa Snowden about the phenomenon of bloating and how bloating in many ways can adversely affect on so many people's lives and some of the ways in which you can maybe think about curing bloating and so on. We might squeeze in a view from Geoffrey Dennis talking about a new charity for coping for animals or sharing care for animals overseas. And Alan Stevens, of course, will be talking about the 40th anniversary of Blake 7, a show you probably never...
Oh, yes, I did see it, yes.
There we are, you see, with Gareth Thomas and Paul Darrow and many
that's
other
right.
fine folk there. So that's
yes, the main character's died, hasn't he? The,
Gareth Thomas.
The guy played Blake, yes.
And indeed, Blake, his character, also died. But that's another story for another time. Sometimes just have to work our way through that. Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, I always like talking about myself, yes.
Oh, exactly. as we said, it's one of those early February days where skeleton crew, from that point of view, midweek drivers having to do all sorts of other bits and pieces, heading off doing paid work. It's astounding, but still, never mind. Life continues. Will you be back with us next week?
Yes, I hope so.
That's what we like to hear. so much Echo Beach, but going over to Wales on a zip wire. Eva McDonald's in the studio. How are you, Eva?
Thank you.
Marvellous. Now, what's this thing before we actually head up to the news that you'll be doing in Wales next week?
I'm going to Zip World.
Mm-hmm.
And Zip World is located, I can't pronounce the name, Bethesda, I think it's called.
It's Welsh. Okay, just carry on.
Somewhere in North Wales.
Yes.
And I thought, why not have a go? I'm terrified of heights, but, you know, it's on the bucket list, so I'll go try it.
There you go. Eva McDonald on a zip wire. Surely it would be better if it was called Velcro World, but no, it's a genuine zip wire. After the news, we'll speak more about that and other things, and much more details on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for Siren Radio. Cue the news.
FM. Online.